Good morning. So last time we looked a bit about how the XV6 scheduler worked. And we saw that it had this design where there was one thread in the kernel which was running this infinite loop where it just iterated through this list of processes, looked for runnable ones, and then it switched to the thread of the runnable one. And when that was done, either because like it waited for I/O or because a timer interrupt happened, it would switch back to the scheduler thread and it would continue in that infinite loop, keeping on forever. Then we talked about the policy side of scheduling. You know, a mechanism for switching to processes, for the context switch itself, and for how we now invoke the scheduler. Talked about, well, how do we choose what process to run if we're not making the simplest possible decision, which was what XV6 did. It's just like whatever was next in the table. And we had some metrics we looked at, which were some of several possible metrics. So one was throughput, that we want to use our CPU efficiently. Another was response time, that we want it to be the case that when I run something, I get back an answer soon. In particular, if I'm doing something that's responding to my input, it's usually important that I see the results of that soon. And we talked about fairness, the idea that if we have multiple people sharing a system, like all of you are SSH'd into the department lab machines, you'd like everyone to get like roughly the same share and not have one person get a lot more, maybe. Then we talked about two of the simplest scheduling algorithms, first come, first served, and round robin. So first come, first served is just we run whatever's first until it can't run. Let me stop. And round robin, we add preemption to that. We decide that we're gonna sometimes interrupt things even though they can keep running and run something else. And in round robin, we just have a fixed length of time after which we do that. And this is basically the policy XV6 uses, that things run until either they run out of time because a timer interrupt happens, or until they can't run anymore because like they're waiting for a key press. And we looked at how first come, first served and round robin interacted with our notion metrics of response time. And one discovery we made was that, well, if we want to have the best response time, you want to run things which are shortest first. And so, motivated by that, I introduced this idea of priority scheduling, that we can just say some applications are more important than others. One reason is maybe they take less time, so to optimize response time, you want to run them sooner. Another reason might be some sort of more human preference, like I want to run faculty jobs before student jobs, because I've made a decision that faculty's programs are more important than students. So we introduced priority scheduling, and we just barely mentioned this shortest job first scheduling, which is going to be what we're going to do when we want to optimize response time. So I have a bunch of other things to talk about before we get back to shortest job first. So first of all, the next homework is on the scheduler. In the interest of not worrying about how far I get today and also trying to do the homeworks at the same time as Grimshaw's section so our TAs don't go crazy, we'll release the scheduler homework next week. Also, so you have time to take advantage of the late policy for the shell homework if you want to do that. This will give you a little more time to do that rather than having it right after. So it's just delayed by a week, and every homework after it's delayed by a week up to the midterm, which there was time in the schedule to do, and that was why there was time in the schedule to do that. And that will involve some things we'll probably get to today, assuming things go fast enough, maybe not. But Grimshaw is like just enough behind that he probably won't. And some of you probably want time to take advantage of the late policy for the shell homework. By the way, there is a late policy if you forgot. And it's like not a trivial late policy. I know a lot of people want extensions for the shell homework and think it's a very hard homework, and maybe it is. I note that the policy on credit hours says that the amount of work you're supposed to be doing in this class, the amount of work an average student is supposed to be doing in this class should work out to about 9 hours a week. That's what the university policy is about a 3-credit hour class. I don't know, and I thought the shell homework would be well in line with that, given that the parsing is pretty simple compared to what it could be in prior semesters. Maybe I'm not right, but like that's where I was targeting. But generally, I don't do extensions for the whole class. My main reason for that is I know some people like started the homework last weekend, which is probably when you should have if you do most of your homeworks on weekends, given that you don't have another one. And I don't want to tell those people, sorry, you should have guessed what I would do and not spent time last weekend. I might do late policy adjustments. That's the sort of thing I might be willing to be more generous with, like changing the percentages or the times for the late policy. But I'm generally not gonna just give a blanket extension. I might do more specific extensions, like if you're traveling for an interview, or you're sick, or something like that, we can talk about that. But not just blanket, the homework is hard extensions. Okay, and I'd like to talk about one annoying C/C++ issue that I saw a couple people run into on the homework. I hope that I would have saw this on Tuesday more and not realize there was a problem by Thursday, but okay. And that's execv has this prototype according to the people who wrote POSIX. They helpfully gave it, said that it's a char star const star. If you don't remember or never learned how to read pointer declarations with const, which is very likely because who would do that? Doesn't come up very often. This is a pointer to const and pointer to char. And it really should be a pointer to constant char, because execv doesn't modify the strings you pass in. But it isn't, for no good reason. And this means if you have an array of pointers to constant char, that if you try to pass it, you get an error in C++. This is might not be an error. Yeah, this is error in C++. I don't think it's an error in C, I'm not sure. Or it probably is in C. Yeah, so it's an error in C++. I'm not sure about C. C is a lot more generous with converting between const and non-constant C++s. It's probably why this didn't get fixed in POSIX way, way back in the 80s or 90s. But the solution is you can cast. That cast is safe because we know even though it takes a pointer to immutable char, it doesn't actually change it. So you don't need to worry about it being constant strings. So questions about this? Yeah.
So I think there was a Stack Overflow response about this. Are we allowed to use like that for something like this where it's just about formatting?
So yeah, so the question is, I found a Stack Overflow response about this, can I use that? As long as you're not doing something that is one of the goals of the assignment, so you're not like you're not using Stack Overflow to tell you how to use execv pipe, redirections, fork, etc. Anything that's like actually really like one of the things listed in the top about what you're supposed to be doing, like it's fine. But if it's anything that's like listed as one of the requirements of the assignment, no. And if you're in doubt, you can ask me about the specific case. But something like, how does C++ work, which is basically what this is fine. And before I move on, any questions about the shell homework? Or from the people who bothered to come to lecture? Yeah. So how is WaitPid supposed to work? So question is on WaitPid. So WaitPid, in our shell assignment, we tell you to output the exit codes in order. So that means that you're gonna have a list of PIDs in the order they appear to the command line, and you're just going to call WaitPID on the first one, then WaitPID on the second one, and so on. So you're going to call them in order, and when you call wait PID, so each time you're going to call it with both your PID and a status. And you don't need to pass any options for this assignment. And you're going to look in this status. This contains the exit code that you need to print out. It is not equal to the exit code. You need to use a macro to extract it. So on the, I believe it's the 4th September slides, I think it's the 4 SEP slides, have an example with W exit status to get the code. So you'll use that to extract it and just print it out like with cout. Does that answer what you were looking for?
This might be like too basic, but I'm not sure why the child processes aren't forking.
What do you mean? Why you're only calling fork in the parent?
Yeah. Why you're only calling fork for each command instead of for each like exponentially?
So what we want to end up is we have our shell, and remember my tree of processes? So we have our shell, this is A, and when we run a command like, I should just do something that's short so I can write it down. So foo pipe to bar, we want foo to be a child process, so this is parent. And we want bar to be a child process. And we want this for two reasons. So one reason is that we're probably going to make the pipe in the shell, and we want to have that file descriptor go to both the foo, the file descriptors from that go to both foo and bar. And the easiest way to do that is to create in the shell and do that. The other reason is we want to wait for both parts of the pipeline to finish, and we can do that in the shell because we're running our own code. We can't do that in foo because we're running the foo executable, and the foo executable doesn't have a wait PID in it that does what we want. So we have to have our own. Same with bar. Does that make more sense? Yeah.
How does it know when the previous command finishes?
How do you know when the command finished?
Yeah.
Before in your shell?
Yeah. In the pipeline. How does the command know to wait for one of the...
So you're talking about, are you talking about how does bar in this foo to bar pipeline know that foo is done?
Yeah.
The reason it knows is that when it reads from its input, it gets end of file. Okay. And it gets end of file because everything that had the other end of the pipe is closed.
Gotcha.
And that happens when the program exits, because when the program exits, all of its file descriptors are closed. Yes.
So I know there's like two test cases where output redirection in the middle of the command or in the beginning is valid.
Yeah.
Is that also true for input redirection?
Yes, it should be.
Okay. But for either case, the name of the file should be right after the character, right?
Yes. In the case where you have redirection, you have your redirection operator greater than or less than, and the next word, where it's space separated for us, is the file, always. Yes, back there.
So as far as when you're like originally looking at the entire command the user is giving you, how specific should our like error checking be? Like, are the errors that it prints out? So if they forgot to put like a file name after the redirection, like, are we supposed to check to see that that is there? Like, how specific should this check be?
So the question is, what should you do for various invalid inputs? So the first rule is never crash. So under no circumstances should you crash an invalid input. You should print out invalid command if like there's a redirection operator at the end of the line, like there's no word to see. And also there's some test cases you should print out invalid command if we like redirect from pipe. You shouldn't try to figure out if something is a real file name or not otherwise.
Okay.
other questions? I thought I saw a few. Yeah. So when should I use fflush? So fflush is for printf. So if you aren't using printf in Friends, you probably shouldn't use fflush. The equivalent with cout is that endl flushes, but it also prints out a new line, and there's also a flush, I believe. Usually this isn't something you need to worry about much, but that would be the solutions in C, in C++, for if you're using IO streams. Yeah. And that's when you use it. The main issue is if you fork, you copy your buffers, and that could be very confusing. Which means that both the child could output what was pre-buffered and the parent. So you might use it before forking if you're worried that you're going to output something from the child. Yeah. Yes, our submission site accepts as many submissions as you like. We do keep copies of all of them, so please like, don't upload 10,000. Yeah.
Can you please explain the difference between what do
those
do?
Okay, so the question is, what does dupe 2 do? We'll just switch back here for, so dupe 2. So if we remember, we had our array of files. So we had in our struct proc, we had pointers to a file, file end of, end file. I don't remember what the actual size was. So dupe 2 from A to B basically does O file of B equals O file of A. So now when you use B as a file descriptor and index into that array, it means the same, exactly the same thing as A, since they're pointers to the exact same thing. Any output that would be directed to B now goes where A was. It's the direction of the assignment. You can think of it as draw an arrow from A to B here, because this is A, then B. And I guess possibly a confusing thing is if after this I do close, say, A, what that's basically doing is it's doing O file of A equals null. So it doesn't change B. Yeah.
I'm just a bit confused by the redirection. Like, so let's say I'm trying to write to a file, right? You open the file, you get an integer, and then like you do the redirection, and then you close it. But after you close it, you run execb. Like, how is the program still working?
So the question is, you open a file, you dupe 2 in the child, and then you run exec v. You close the file, and then you exec v.
Yeah, so like, how is that program like reading from it or writing to it if you already closed it?
So when you dupe 2, you've made it so it's one of its O file entries points to that file, and exec v doesn't change that. So after the exec v, it still points to the same file. That's how it works. Over there. So if you open the file
in the parent, you have closed in the parent as well as in the child,
So the question is, if I open a file in the parent, do I have to close it in both the parent and the child? If you want it closed, yes. Because when we fork, we have our child O file is just going to be a copy of O file. So we're going to have pointers to all the same things. So if you want to if you clear an entry in the child, it doesn't do anything to the parent because it's a copy of the table. So if you want both of them cleared, you have to do that. You have to close them both. Other questions? Okay, so in that case, let's move on and talk about where we left off with scheduling. So when we left off on scheduling, we mentioned that if we're doing first come, first serve, we just run something until it can't run. The best order had the shortest things first for response time. Maybe not the best order for other things, but for response time, that was best. And this was the same as priority, where the CPU length determines priority. So we're going to call this shortest job first. I'm going to use shortest job first to refer to the version without preemption. So we're doing priority equals job length, you know, here. If you do that with preemption, if you do the simplest possible thing, it doesn't quite work, we'll fix it later. So we're just doing no preemption, but priority scheduling. So whenever we have something stop running, we choose the thing with the highest priority, and our priority is what has the shortest length. So there's a little bit of a problem here, which is, okay, so we want to run the shortest CPU burst first. So I just need to look at my processes and figure out which one is going to use the least CPU time before it's done. So how can I do that? Well, you probably don't remember anything in our XV6 thread struct, process struct to do that. And indeed, we can't generally. We'll have some kind of working solutions for this later. But this is a problem. Like, we don't actually know. So let's look at how this looks like. And we're going to say that we have programs which do some CPU, spend a fixed amount of time doing I/O, then do some CPU again, then spend a fixed amount of time doing I/O, and so on. And they just repeat that forever in some fixed pattern. And we're going to look what shortest job first looks like here. And this is the first time we're really looking at like the more realistic version of the scheduling problem, which is that we don't just have a bunch of things that we start and then don't care what happens afterwards. We're looking at sort of a continuous system where things are running all the time, which is more like what we're used to on our desktop or laptop. It's not the case that I just start all my programs at once, they use the CPU for a bit, and then they're done. I have all things running all the time. They're like talking to the screen, to the network, and so on. And I want to run them efficiently. So here's a schedule from this. So let's look at what happens here. So initially we say these are all runnable, just to keep things simple. So we run the shortest one first, then the next shortest one, and then the third shortest one. And after this shortest one run, after a while, right about here, while this program A is running, it becomes runnable again. And that means that when program A finishes, we look at our runnable programs. There's exactly one, and it's program B, so we run program B. Program B also happens to be the shortest of the exactly one programs, so it was an easy decision. Then program C finishes I/O while program B is running. So when program B finishes, program C is the only runnable program, that's what we run. So then we run program C for a while, and then we have a period where we don't have anything to run, so the CPU is idle. And we wait until something happens, and eventually program A finishes its I/O and becomes runnable again, so we run it. And while it's running, program B finishes and program A finishes. Program C finishes. And they get to run in order of how much CPU they use. So program B first after program A is done. And we just repeat that forever. So you may notice that for this sort of pattern, when we started out and have everything runnable, we did take advantage of getting of this shortest job first policy and actually like have a better response time here. that. Because we ran program B quickly, we got it to get to its IO quicker, and that's going to be better for the user of program B probably than program C. But later on here, we still had our convoy effect. And we still have programs waiting in line behind this big program, and that's just because we can't interrupt program A, and things didn't become runnable at the right time. But it's not as bad, because at least, you know, after program A is done, we run things in the right order. We always run program C first, so at least we're minimizing the extra wait it would have by waiting also behind program B, which just takes a while. So our solution here is going to be to add preemption. So the straightforward thing is that we have a long job running, medium job interrupts it, we want to run the medium job sooner probably. So the idea is if the new job is shorter, run it now. And that seems pretty straightforward here. We'd say, okay, so program C, it's finished here, we should just run it right away. That's what your notion might be. So that seems like a reasonable idea, but here shows us, yeah, and here it would make sense. It would be the right thing to do. Like we'd want to run program C right here, interrupting program A, because program A is going to take a while, it's less important. But this doesn't work in general. And the issue is, what if A is almost done running? Like A has like a millisecond left to do. And we have like a job that's like program C interrupts it. Something that's going to take less time than A overall, but way more than the long job has left. So priority equal job length isn't the right metric when we're dealing with this, because we want that long job to get credit for being almost done. We want to say, it's almost done, we should let it finish, rather than running this other thing which has some actual work to do. So the solution is that instead of making the priority equal to the total time, we make it equal to the remaining time. So every time we have a scheduling decision, we look at who has the least time left, regardless of how long they take overall. And if we apply that to the same situation, we end up doing the right thing here. So here we interrupt, have program B interrupt program A, then program A finishes, and program B went first here because this chunk of program A is longer than program B. So program B, when it interrupted, it got to go first. But later on, when program C becomes ready right here, it doesn't start right away, even though it's a shorter job, because it has the amount of stuff it has left to do is way more than program A does. Because program A just has this little sliver, and to give good response time, we want to let that finish. You know, it's not worth having that little sliver of work wait. And we apply that repeatedly. So, questions about what I did here? Shortest remaining time first policy? Yeah.
Where is the gap between the two bars?
The gap? What do you mean? Which gap?
You go to the right, like a white gap.
This gap?
Yeah.
So here, we just program A finished, and it takes this long to get do its next I/O. Program B finished here, and it takes until this time to do its next I/O. And program C finished here, and it takes till here to do its next I/O. So every program is doing I/O, so there's nothing to run on the CPU. And in a real operating, so in XV6, what would happen in that case is our scheduler would be running its infinite loop over and over again, saying, oh, not runnable, not runnable, not runnable, and just infinitely looping over the process table. In a smarter OS, the scheduler would detect, oh, there's no runnable processes. I'm going to run some instruction on the CPU that will save a bit of power. It's the usual thing that will happen. Yes?
Do those gaps actually happen, though?
The question is, do gaps like this actually happen? Yes. Yes, they do happen, especially on things like desktops, which, you know, the average CPU utilization on your desktop is probably like 1%. Because a lot of the time it's just sitting there displaying things, which doesn't actually use CPU typically, the same thing, and maybe running something like a couple milliseconds every second. Yeah. So yeah, it does happen on real systems. And yeah, and the typical thing is you run some instruction that saves some power on the processor, but not like, but not something like putting the CPU to sleep, because that takes a long time if you get I/O finishing. Yeah.
In that second chunk showing what's happening in the CPU, how come the green program doesn't start?
So the question is right here: why does program B start before program A? So what's happening here is program B and program A are ready at the same time. And so we have a list of two, sorry?
Could you go back one? It looks like the second thing of A is ready.
So this is, the line for A goes to here, the line for B goes to here. They should be exactly coincidental. Is that, I'm not, no, I know there's lots of black lines, and maybe I should have like figured out a way of using colors or something. But the idea is.
So like, why doesn't it, like, the top A, it looks like it's lined up right after C.
The top A here?
Yeah, like, can it not start until the figure aligns?
So, lined up right after C. So assuming I measured things correctly, which it is possible I didn't. This gap and this gap should be equal to this gap and this gap. But it's possible I measured incorrectly when I made this plot. Yes?
I think like, the reason is because A didn't get to finish the first time, so it's not waiting for input output yet. So like, the above line, like the matchup.
Right. Oh, sorry, yes. So I guess maybe part of the confusion here is that this is the pattern of the program. But what we're saying is that typically, if we do, if A gets to run on the CPU like this and then this, because like it gets interrupted here, then it only gets to do I/O here, and the I/O is the same length. Does that make sense? So in a case like this, where you know this is where the A's I/O starts, and the arrows at the bottom are supposed to represent the time doing I/O, and because A needs to do all that computation before it can start its I/O. Like it's not done computing like whatever it's going to send to the network. And that's the idea of the patterns in each of these hypothetical examples. Of course, I'm drastically simplifying what real programs do with this model, that like the I/O takes a fixed amount of time. That's not what really happens. It's just to show sort of some sort of dynamic case for this. Other questions? Okay, so if you take these policies, so shortest job first is the policy that minimizes response time or waiting time as we've defined it. Assuming you can't do preemption and you don't believe in leaving the CPU deliberately idle. By leaving the CPU deliberately idle, I mean, like one way of avoiding the convoy effect here would be to say when A becomes runnable, I just don't run it right away, I wait for things to finish. Assuming you aren't willing to do that. Like, assuming we say if something's runnable, I want to run something, then shortest job first is the policy that minimizes response time without preemption. You could potentially do better by saying, oh, there's only one thing runnable, I'm gonna wait for more things to become runnable. But most people aren't willing to say, I'm going to leave the CPU idle when things are runnable. That's kind of a scary thing to say. And shortest remaining time first is the policy which minimizes response time. You know, there's like, you can prove this if you ignore context switch costs. Assuming switching between programs is free, it minimizes response time. It's the absolute best you can do, period. Obviously here, like, we have extra context switches. We have this context switch back to A we wouldn't have had otherwise. So if you don't ignore context switches, it could do worse than other policies. If those context switch costs add up to enough that the sort of benefit in the ordering is not enough. So questions about these conclusions? Okay, so we have this problem we mentioned earlier about let's know job lengths. You know, we want to know how long a job is, so we can compute how long it is for shortest job first, so we can compute the remaining time for shortest remaining time first. How do you do this? So one solution is you could ask. And in something like a batch job scheduling system, this is actually a common practice. So in a supercomputer, it's common for the job submission systems you use there. You say, I want to run this climate simulation, and it's going to take 2 days. That's a common thing to do on those systems. And sometimes when I tell them it's going to take 2 days, it's even kind of accurate. Sometimes maybe it only takes a day. And I, you know, just was being conservative. And you could imagine doing this in a desktop scenario. You could imagine a program saying, I'm interactive, I have short time slices, I'm a CPU intensive thing, I have long time slices. You could imagine someone telling you that. You could also imagine making guesses. You could say, oh, this is reading from the terminal, it's probably interactive. This is only reading and writing from files, it's probably not. And make guesses that way about, you know, whether it has a short or a long CPU burst. And therefore, as far as we're concerned, it has a short job or a long job. And these are all things that people have tried to do. But typically, you don't want to rely on the people writing the program telling you what their job length is. One reason is if I have an interactive system and I tell you it uses shortest remaining time first, and you can tell me how long your CPU bursts are, what should you tell me if you want to get the most CPU? Really short. You should just say, promise, I only need a microsecond. Oh, it took longer? I just need a microsecond. It's okay. Like, that's what you'll say, because you'll get the most. And you can imagine ways of making, discouraging this. Like, you could say, if you say you only need a microsecond, I'll kill you if you take too long. And then you get other wrong answers, because if I tell you, you need to tell me how long your CPU burst is, and if you're wrong, I'm going to kill your program. What are you going to tell me? You're gonna take your best estimate and like multiply it by 100. And this is a common thing which happens on batch systems. So in batch systems, they usually, you say, I want to run this climate simulation for 2 days. Usually that means if you take longer than 2 days, it gets killed. So when people have analyzed what numbers do people tell us for these batch systems, where it's easier to estimate than for like interactive programs, usually their estimates are a little high because they want to make sure their program finishes and doesn't get killed for exceeding the amount of time they set. Usually only modestly high, like twice as, like half the time they say on average, something like that. Maybe better for people who have run their job more, or if they have a program which can use as much time as they have. And they just want to get killed. But we don't really want to ask, we just want to figure this out as an operating system. And we can't exactly go into the code and analyze, you know, how long is this going to take if you remember like the halting problem from some theory course. You may know that that's impossible. If we can't tell if it halts or not before we do I/O, we sure can't tell how long it's going to take. So we need to make some informed guesses. And the basic strategy we're going to use is going to be that we're going to look at past behavior. But first I'm going to show you, as part of doing this, an approximation of shortest job first or shortest remaining time first. And that's going to be, we're going to use priority scheduling, but we're not going to have everything's priority be, you know, the amount of time. We're just going to divide things up into buckets. So we're going to have a small number of priorities, and we're going to say that, you know, priority, this top priority is for things that have the 0 to 1 milliseconds of CPU each time they get on. These have a 1 to 10, these have 10 to 20, and these have 20 plus. And the priority level tells us how much time you're supposed to be using, and we'll in fact adjust the quantums based on that. We'll run something like round robin for each of these priorities with a quantum that's based on how long you should be taking. So the idea is that if we have you in the wrong bucket, well, we at least switch away from you to the other things in the same bucket after the appropriate amount of time. Now, to do this, we still need to somehow get you into the right bucket. We still need to find out where are the 0 to 1 millisecond programs versus the 20 plus millisecond programs. So, and you know, not any of these fields. You can't like read these fields to do it. You could maybe guess. And one guess you might make in XV6 is you might say, okay, let's look at this open files. Which are any of them the terminal? You could make a guess based on that. Probably not actually very helpful, but maybe that would be better than nothing. But the basic way we're going to do this is we're going to make this observation that the way a program behaves now is likely how it's going to behave in the near future. So we're just going to look at how long did you take the last couple times. And we're going to say, well, that's probably how long you'll need on the CPU the next couple times. This is a heuristic. It's meaning a guess, an informed guess, a guess that's often right, a guess that if you look at real programs, you can justify as being right a lot of the time. But there's no fundamental reason why it has to be even mostly right. And we're going to apply this heuristic with that model of having different priorities with buckets of time. And the idea is that for each of those buckets, we'll assign a quantum length. We'll say that if you're at priority 3, you get to use 1 millisecond and then you're done. If you're at priority 2, you get to use 10 milliseconds and then you're done. So we run round robin at each of these priorities with a different quantum length. Yes?
So does it, like, for priority 0, if you run 100 milliseconds, does it take the whole 100 milliseconds, or does it just go into the process?
So the question is for priority 3. In this model, we're saying that we're going to take 100 milliseconds. Now, this doesn't correlate quite with here, I said 20 plus. It would be reasonable to say maybe we could just do first come, first served. I chose to do 100 milliseconds. Both are fine choices. Probably the reason to do a time slice like 100 milliseconds is to prevent starvation.
Well, your process T is 80 milliseconds. Well, if it's 80 milliseconds, what is the extra 20 milliseconds?
So the question is, if process T takes 80 milliseconds, what are we going to do? So first of all, we have to get down there because we're going to always run the things in the top first. But if it takes 80 milliseconds, then it's going to not be runnable, and we're going to generally have a policy that we don't want to leave the CPU idle if something's runnable, so we'll move on to processing. And in this policy, we're saying we should give it 100 milliseconds, too. We're going to somehow measure time better than just waiting for the next timer interrupt. Like, we're going to look at how many milliseconds have passed on each timer interrupt, for example. So this is assuming to get variable time slices that we're doing something smarter than just looking for a timer interrupt that like either we change the amount of time between timer interrupts when we change which bucket we're using, or we check the time when we get a timer interrupt and see have 10 milliseconds actually passed. Okay. So once we have this, assignment, and this is going to be assuming we assign things to buckets correctly, and we're going to adjust where things are based on how they run. So we're going to run the highest priority process. That's always our scheduling decision. And if it used its whole time slice, so we run process A here, that's the thing we run, it's the first thing runnable. And if it used its whole time slice, and it still wants to run, we're going to add it to the lower priority queue. We're going to move it down in priority. We're going to say, you don't deserve to be at priority 2 because you're taking more than 10 milliseconds. You should be in the 10 to 20 bucket. So we're going to move it down to that bucket based on our observation. And if it finished early, when process A becomes runnable sometime later after it does I/O, we're going to remember that it took less time than 10 milliseconds and started at priority 3. Yeah.
So what would cause it to stay in the same bucket?
In this policy, we won't. You can imagine adding a third option where we do. I'm just doing the simplest version. And note that we're only checking, in this case, I'm only checking, like, did it use the whole time slice or not? That's a simple decision. You could imagine doing something more sophisticated where you look at like exactly how much time did it use and like have 3 or even more choices. But this is the simplest version, and this simple decision is pretty practical. Also note that use the whole time slice, we're actually asking the same question, why did it go to sleep? Did it go to sleep because of a timer interrupt, or did it go to sleep because it was waiting for something? So it's a very easy piece of code to add just to the place where you do that. Yes?
So if process A took like 13 milliseconds,
and then it would go down to priority 1. Yeah, so if process A took 13 milliseconds, it would go down to priority 1, would run its remaining 3 milliseconds at priority 1. That would be less than the time slice at priority 1, and it would get moved back up. Yeah.
Is that like a negligible amount of time to like switch its priority before you do the next one? Because it seems like if in that scenario process A just then like put down and then back up, it seems like a waste.
It's not very inefficient. But you could imagine if you're concerned about that, maybe you do some more intelligent heuristic for moving it up and down. And there's lots of extra things you might do. I'm giving you the sort of basic outline for how you do this. And you can certainly imagine those things you could add to try to make it act smoother. The important thing is that the process, ends up around the right priority. That's what's important, is that all the adjustments we make ends up where around where its time slice says it should be. Yeah?
Where would the buckets be stored? Like, where does the CPU look at the...
So the question is, what data structure would I use for this? So in an operating system that implements this, a common thing to do is you have an array of 4 linked lists. And that's what it would, and the linked list of struct procs, and that's what you do. And the moving is just deciding what linked list you put it on when it's runnable again. And scheduling is you remove the first linked list, run it for its quantum, and so on. Yeah.
Do you always start it at 3 or 0, or is there like another heuristic to decide where it should start?
So where do we start? We always run the highest priority first. Well, when you're adding a program, where do you start it? That is a question I haven't answered, and there are multiple sane answers. The answer, if you're worried about like responding to the user, is probably you start it at 3 and let it work its way down, but I could imagine defenses for other answers too. Yeah, you start it at 3 because you want to run it so you know where it fits. And so the basic idea is that by making these higher priorities, these shorter jobs at shorter time slices, we kind of enforce that they're not lying to us about how long they actually need. And we adjust where they go based on what actually happens. We look at how long did they take the last time, and we assume that they're going to take roughly the same amount the next time as far as when we decide to run them. Whether we decide to run them earlier because they took a short amount of time, we assume they're going to take a short amount of time again, so we should run them earlier to give better response time. And the idea is that by moving things up and down in the queue, that things end up fluctuating between the bucket they're supposed to be in and one above or below. So they end up in the right place. There's a little fluctuation. There's going to be more because, you know, you probably think of A takes 13 milliseconds every time. It probably is like A takes 5 to 20 milliseconds every time, and then like it's kind of random. So there's more fluctuation anyways, but we kind of always end up at the right place. Or close to it. Okay. So this is a real scheduling algorithm that some operating systems have used. So let's say that, you know, I told you that, say, the department lab machines, USSH2 use this, and you wanted to use all the CPU. You have this big simulation, you want to get it running tonight, you want to finish it. How should you use all the CPU if you know this is the policy? Yeah?
You just like stop your program like 1 millisecond, and then make it like 1 millisecond,
and just keep doing that. Yeah. So you just run for a little less than the minimum quantum, so you run for like 0.9 milliseconds. Then you do some I/O, which takes a trivial amount of time, and then you run again. And if you can get that I/O take less than a millisecond, you're running for more than half the CPU, assuming no one else is doing something similar. So this is gameable. If you wanted to cheat this system, you can. And another concern is maybe programs would accidentally have a pattern like this by accident. Like, if they're doing disk I/O in the right way, they might accidentally do something like this, where they end up having maybe a higher priority than you'd like them to have. And this can come up in other situations. So here, I have a bunch of programs running. I have A, some very long computation that doesn't use any I/O. I have B1 through B100,000, which are processing data on disk, so they read some data from disk, process it, write some data to disk. And I have C, which is an interactive program. And this system is going to should correctly identify the interactive program, uses really short time slices, it gets to run. Great. So now we have good responsiveness despite running all these extra programs for our interactive program. So we've accomplished our mission. Now, part of our mission wasn't anything about how much time does A get. So how much time does program A here get, that long computation?
Like basically none.
Why?
Because it's likely that one of B1 through B1000 is at a higher priority and is ready at all times.
Yeah, so there's not all these B programs, they have time slices which aren't forever, aren't in the bottom bucket, and there's enough of them that one of them should always be ready, should always get to run. So A gets no time, this is another case of starvation. So this multi-level queuing is unfair in this sense, that A gets no time whatsoever. So typically, when there's been real implementations of this multi-level queuing where we move things up and down, there's also some additional stuff done, which is again heuristic guesses, to try to avoid starvation. Typically something of the form, if a process hasn't run for a long time, make sure it gets to run at least, just to avoid scenarios like that. We're on a busy system, some program may get absolutely no CPU time. Note that another problem with this is if I add, but now is interactive, like the program did a bunch of computation and now I'm like analyzing my data, I'm making plots, I'm using it as an interactive program, the answer is the same. That's part of the annoyance with this starvation problem. Is that if you become the bottom priority, if you don't have one of these rules like this, you'll never discover that, oh, it really should be higher now than it was before. Okay. Any questions on this idea? So additionally, they do some heuristic, there's multiple choices. One idea you could do is you could just say, if a program hasn't run for 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds, move it up a priority or something like that. Okay. So this is sort of an ad hoc way of providing fairness. And we're gonna look at another family of scheduling algorithms where we're gonna say, our first priority isn't going to be response time. Our first priority is fairness. We're going to do the fairest scheduling we can. And our intuition is if we start with our one thread equals one user model, is that, you know, if thread user, which maybe isn't true, but we'll start with that to keep things simple, is that every thread has an equal chance of being chosen. So, given that, here's a fair scheduling algorithm, one which has really seriously been proposed. Just take all the runnable processes, choose uniformly at random, choose a random number, run that program. It's really elegant because you don't need to keep track of any state. Like, you don't need to remember which bucket is this program in, how much time did it use in this last time slice. You just make a decision based on what's there, choose at random, and it's great for fairness. Good for fairness. It's pretty bad for response time. It's not horrible. It's pretty bad for predictability because we're making random scheduling decisions. And this scheduling algorithm is very similar to what we're going to have you implement for the scheduler homework. Going to be a variant of this, and we'll get to that shortly, probably today even. So one thing we might say is, so this is good for fairness. What does fairness mean? And there's multiple definitions, as I alluded to earlier. I'm going to give you one definition of fairness that gives us like a numerical measurement. And that's maximum of minimum. That we'll say, this is one way of measuring fairness, it's not the only way, and you can quibble, but this says we want to maximize the minimum resources any thread gets. So in some sense, this is avoiding starvation is another way of thinking about it. We want to have the most starved thread not be as less starved as possible. And so under this metric, this schedule here, where everything gets the same amount of time, is the most fair. Something uneven like this, we look at this amount of time. Here we look at this amount of time, and this is the least fair because this gets less time. It's a smaller amount of time, it's more starved. So this mostly matches people's intuition for what counts as fair, but you could make a reasonable case that maybe you want to say that the last thing I have is least fair is not less fair than the other one. If you want to do that, there's other definitions which will say otherwise. So questions about this idea? Yeah. So the question is, why can't you go in order? You could also go in order. So the question is, why did I do random? The issue is that we have threads entering and leaving the system. So order is a little less straightforward than we'd like it to be. But we will talk about a scheduling algorithm which essentially does some notion of going in order. But it's more complicated because the threads aren't runnable all the time. And we have to answer the question of what if the next thread is not runnable now? When do we run it? And we'll see an answer for that when we talk about, in fact, the scheduler that Linux uses by default now. Yeah?
If you were to just implement round-robin with a fairness algorithm, would that improve like response time?
The question is, if I just implemented round-robin with
fairness, so like, you pick one at random, but it only gets like a maximum of like 20 milliseconds, and then you
can watch the next. This is usually what we're talking about when doing this, yes. So we get, would it improve response time? Maybe. This like doesn't give you very many guarantees about response time, right? And it's probably, like an expectation is probably as good as round robin, because an expectation you do basically the same thing round robin does. Like on average, the next time you run is the same, you wait the same amount of time as round robin. And it might be a bit worse, depending on what you care about for response time, because of this predictability issue. That, you know, sometimes you'll run, take a while to run because you get unlucky. That might be bad, really bad for response time, actually, like compared to what round robin does. Because with round robin, like you have a bound in how long you have to wait to run, based on if there's 10 programs in the system, you have to wait at most 10 time quanta. With this, if there's 10 programs in the system, you could still wait 100 time quanta to run. So it could be much worse for response time if you get unlucky, and that's going to happen some percentage of the time if like you measure over a minute. So this is basic fairness. So we also, sometimes, we want to have something like priorities combined with this. So we're gonna have this notion of proportional share. That we're gonna say, for example, that thread A is twice as important as thread B. And we're not gonna do the thing we did with priority, where if we say, with priority, if we say thread A is twice as important as thread B, then thread A gets all the CPU and thread B gets none. That's not what we want to do. That's not usually what people think of when we say twice as important. That's what priority would do. Instead, we want to give thread A twice as much CPU as thread B. So we're going to give it its proportional share. So we want to run thread A twice as much as thread B. And the scheduling algorithm we're going to have you implement for the scheduling homework is going to be implementing something which provides this property. That we can say thread A is twice as important as thread B and have thread A run twice as much as thread B. And we're gonna use this sort of simplest possible fair algorithm of just choose uniformly at random, except it's not gonna be uniform. We're gonna make a weighted choice. And this is called lottery scheduling. The idea is that each thread has a certain number of lottery tickets, and every time we need to choose what thread to run, we run a lottery. So we take all our tickets, we lay them out of the line, we choose a random ticket from that line, and that's the program that gets to run. This idea makes sense. And so our scheduling algorithm is look at the current tickets each thread has, choose a random number based on that, choose the thread which has that ticket number, basically. Yes?
Who says how many tickets each process has?
So who says how many tickets each process has? So this is a policy decision. And the idea is that whoever decided that thread A is twice as important as thread B hopefully told us by setting the number of tickets. And you could imagine doing things like saying, I'm going to set the number of tickets based on what your time slice usage was. So I'm going to make it so interactive things have more tickets than other things, and so on. The idea is that this is a mechanism you can use by setting the number of tickets for lots of different goals. So in particular, let's say you want to do priority scheduling. You can simulate it with lottery scheduling. You just give your high priority program way, way, way more tickets than the other programs. And you can adjust this ratio to control how much starvation happens. If you make them only have 10 times as much, then you've avoided starvation in a way. If you make them have a million times as much, you have more starvation. But you kind of have this controllable knob as to how much, you know, how unfair it is. So the assignment, which, as I said at the beginning of class, we'll do the week after next. You could start it early, both to give you time to do late submissions on shell and just because to keep have TA synced so they aren't confused about what assignment's when, is to add lottery scheduling to XP6. So you're going to add a system called set tickets to set the number of tickets the current process has. That's how the decision's going to be made. Some program's just going to say, give this number of tickets to this thing. And you're also going to count how long processes run, because otherwise, how would you know what your scheduler's doing? And there's some simplifications over what you do if you actually were implementing this in a real OS. So one thing is that we're going to let you make your scheduling decisions be linear time. In a real OS, you probably not want to do that. You probably want to have it be like log n or something most of the time, because iterating through the entire process list, if you have like every time you schedule, can end up being slow if you like have 100 programs running and they all run every second. And we're not going to care about preemption at all. So like in a real lottery scheduler, you might say, if we want to simulate priority good, when program A becomes runnable, we probably should do another lottery to figure out whether program A gets to interrupt whatever B or C was running. We're not going to have you worry about that. We're just going to have you schedule the same times just on the timer interrupts or when the program stops being runnable. Okay. So that's lottery scheduling. And you might say, well, is this actually good? It seems like kind of a silly idea. So it was seriously proposed by academics. And they talked about how you make it efficient, how you do it in not linear time, how you make preemption decisions, which I didn't talk about, but you want to do something different for preemption. What you do about processes that don't use the whole time slice, if you want to do something intelligent about that, how do you handle resources that aren't like CPU and also make scheduling decisions, like how to use this for network or disk scheduling. And it's a nice, elegant mechanism where if you set the ticket numbers correctly, you can implement a variety of policies and types of policies that you can't really do with priority, mainly because priority doesn't give you a good way of preventing there from being starvation, and this does. It has some problems, and this is why you won't find a real OS that actually uses lottery scheduling, though you will find real OSs, such as modern Linux, which use schedulers with a similar goal, where the idea is that processes have a proportional share, and they get that share of the CPU. So let's start with a motivational example as to why. Let's say process A has one ticket and process B has 9 tickets. So process B is 9 times as important as A. So over a 10-time quanta, what's the probability that A runs for 3 of them? Note that the expectation is A should run for 1. Because it has 1 out of 10 of the total tickets in the system. What's the probability it runs for 3 of them? 3 times as much as it's supposed to. And this is probably not a calculation you can do exactly, especially not in your head. So any guesses as like what range? Like is it like 0.1%, 50%? What sort of area are we in? What order of magnitude is the portion of percentage? Yeah.
Fraction of a percent,
you think? Any other guesses? Why a fraction of a percent? So, but we only need 3 of them is the issue. We don't need all of them. All of them, yes, that's a fraction of a percent. So at least B gets to run. That's almost certain. Like, it's almost certain that B gets a chance to run 10-time quanta. But that's what you're computing. The chance that B gets to run 9 of those 10, or, you know, at least 7 of those 10 times is different. Yeah. 1 out of 1,000, your intuition for that?
It's just like 1 over
10
cubed.
1 over 10 cubed?
Yeah.
Okay. Because you think like that. So, yeah, so this is, yeah, sorry.
Would it be 1 over 10 cubed times 10 cubed is 3?
Yeah, so you're saying, you're saying it's about maybe 1 over 10 cubed, but times 10^3 because there's, yeah, there's 10 time quanta, we choose 3 of them to have this happen. So it's something closer to that. So I did this calculation combinatorically and then ran a simulation because I don't trust any time I do combinatorics. I assume I made a mistake somewhere. And this would suggest, if you remember your combinatorics, this is pretty big. There's lots of way of choosing 3 things from 10. You end up with about 7%. So not this like fractional percentage, but because there's lots of different 3 things, we have to get lucky 3 times is the way of thinking about it. And that's not too unlikely to happen over 10 times. Like it's not most of the time, but 7% is kind of annoying if you care about consistency. Because if you think of 10 time quanta as like every 10 is like 100 milliseconds, then some, you know, 100 milliseconds, the program's running a lot more than it's supposed to. Over the long run, it averages out, but if you care about things like response time, this is really annoying. That some bad luck gives you this high variance. And this is the main complaint about lottery scheduling. That this variance is pretty high, and there are alternatives to lottery scheduling, and we'll talk about what Linux uses next time, which avoid this variance, avoid this. Sometimes, you know, our lower share program gets lucky, and for a brief period of time gets more than its share. And that's just because we only had 10 quanta, not like 1,000, where we're not going to get 3 times as much as we're supposed to have over 1,000, but over 10, we can just get unlucky, or lucky, depending on your point of view, and that can happen. Okay, so good luck on the shell homework. I'll see you next time.